This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before making his formal announcement this morning that John Edwards would be his vice presidential running mate, John Kerry emailed his decision to over 1 million subscribers to his website, an unprecedented use of the Internet. We're going to talk about the Internet and politics with Joe Trippi. He pioneered the use of the Internet in presidential politics when he managed Howard Dean's primary campaign last year. Trippi was widely credited with helping Dean transform himself into a frontrunner. Trippi had previously worked on the presidential campaigns of Ted Kennedy, Walter Mondale, Gary Hart, and Richard Gephardt. Now he's written a book called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Democracy, the Internet, and the Overthrow of Everything. I spoke with him last Thursday. Before you had managed the Dean campaign, you'd basically sworn off presidential politics. Why did you swear off presidential politics?
It's the toughest thing that you can do. It's a draining experience. It's physically nearly impossible to get through a presidential. And what happens when you do one is you're absolutely convinced it's the greatest thing you've ever been a part of, and you're absolutely convinced that you will never, ever let yourself do it again. And so in 1980, I did it. I did it in 84. I did it in 88. And in 88, I really swore it off and actually stayed out for 15 years, kept my promise to myself for 15 years. I don't see myself doing another one. Hopefully I can keep that one for at least over 15. And if I do that, I won't be doing another one. They're just really taxing.
Yeah. So why did you decide to work on the Dean campaign?
Well, I didn't want to. It was one of these things. I really did not want to run another presidential or be a part of one again, because it just you don't really believe you're going to live through it if you've been through one. And but I fell in love with him. I went out to Iowa on one trip with him for the first time in 30 or 40 years. I heard a person running for president of the United States actually talking about our responsibility as citizens to each other and not for ourselves, talking about how the greatest country on this planet should be able to provide health care to every one of its citizens, and he meant it, and he had done it in Vermont. And I just, I was in that room in that house in Iowa, and I was screaming at myself to get out of there. If I stayed and listened to him for any longer, I'd end up doing his campaign. And, that side of me won out, and I ended up going up to Burlington. And I think really starting something with Governor Dean that was one of the greatest campaigns, I think, in the last 30 or 40 years. All those people out there that came, that got the message and understood they could make a difference.
So what was the size of the Dean campaign when you took it over?
Oh, we had about 6 or 7 people. We had less than $100,000 in the bank. When I first got up there, we were trying to, it was impossible, nearly impossible to scrape enough money to pay for his next airline ticket to Iowa for him. And we had 432 supporters nationwide. It wasn't anything that you thought, you know, on paper was going to become much of anything. And we had almost no money or resources even to dig ourselves out of the hole we were in.
Now, of course, you thought of using the Internet, really using the Internet, to help gain financial and voting support for Dean. What was your initial idea about how the Internet could be used for the campaign? And I should mention here that you'd worked for high-tech businesses, so you had some experience with the net.
Well, I had, back in the late 90s, visited and spent a lot of time on bulletin boards on the web as just a private citizen as well. And one of the things that happened was I was on this bulletin board that of a company named THQ that made games for PlayStations and Game Boys and Xboxes, of all things. And there was a guy named David Haynes on that board who was just an ordinary citizen. He was very smart. He'd post things, we all learned something about each other. He would post things like, "Guys, I'm sorry I haven't posted for 4 or 5 days, but my wife just gave birth to our baby son, Christian." And later on, he'd tell you how the games were bad, but hey, Christian walked today. And you learned that he had a dog named Bruin and that he was a triathlete, amateur triathlete who lost every race he ever ran in. And you really got to know him as a person. And then one day someone came on that bulletin board and said, "I have tragic news. David Haynes died of a massive heart attack today at age 31, leaving his baby Christian, I think, who was then about 18 months old. And what I saw happen was this funeral on the internet. Every citizens from all over the country who barely didn't know this guy, never met him, but knew everything about him, started eulogizing him. And then we tried to start an education fund for his son. And I remember distinctly thinking, gosh, if you could build a community like this, we don't do these things today for our next door neighbor or the person, too many of us don't, or the person five blocks away in our own neighborhoods. But here was this community that was built around, of all things, a PlayStation game maker. And I thought, that was the first time I thought, wow, what could happen if you use that same kind of community building on the internet for a presidential campaign or to strengthen our democracy or to get people involved in actually changing the country. And that's what we set out to do in the Dean campaign. And the American people now really have a tool that can let them connect with each other in really dynamic and energetic ways. And really, those of us who want to change the country, and I believe most Americans believe they really deep down want to make a difference, they just don't believe they can, but now we have the tools to do it.
One of the things you did in the campaign was through a website called meetup.com, you had Dean supporters being able to communicate with each other. Would you explain how you used this website for the campaign?
Meetup.com is a website that allows people to come together, discuss their hobbies, different interests, and then meet each other offline. We had looked at that site and realized that we had to decentralize the campaign. We had to give people a place to go meet. We didn't have campaign offices in 50 states. And so we got people to sign up at meetup.com, sign up as Dean supporters, and then meet on the first Wednesday of every month. We started out with really a couple thousand people, and by the end of the campaign, we had 190,000 Americans meeting together in their own communities on the first Wednesday of every month. They'd gather there. They'd decide what they were going to do, what precincts they were going to leaflet, what different campaign things they were going to do over the next 30 days, and then they'd come up and come back the next first Wednesday and meet up again and do it all over again. And it was really an astounding thing. I think it was one of the big breakthroughs of the internet this year is that we've now moveon.org and the Dean campaign in particular proved that you can use the internet to get thousands and thousands of people to do things, not on the internet, but in their own communities.
Now, you organized a campaign blog when you were managing Dean's campaign. What did you want the blog to accomplish? And why don't you explain what a blog is for any of our listeners that don't know what a blog is?
Well, first of all, it's the real word for it is weblog. It's a sort of a journal that's kept by usually an individual who, you know, just basically talks about issues or things that interest him, and other people who have that same interest start reading that blog, which is short for weblog. We started the first blog in presidential campaign history. It was called the Call to Action blog. It was ugly and messy and really difficult to navigate, but we were doing things that no one else had ever done before. It would eventually turn into the Blog for America, which was the BMW of blogs. It was really interactive. You could get comments from your supporters, ideas from them, and a lot of the great ideas of the campaign actually came from our own supporters communicating to us on the blog and giving us great ideas that really helped get the campaign off the ground. One of the simple things was we had signs up on our site, you know, Iowans for Iowa for Dean, another New Hampshire voter for Dean, that people could download. We put up all 50 states, and the first mention on the blog was, hey, you forgot Puerto Rico, you screwed up. And we immediately, you know, realized that, yeah, Puerto Rico votes for Democratic nomination. So we put up a Puerto Rico for Dean sign within a minute or two and got a protest from a guy in London saying that he was an American abroad who was going to vote in the presidential, and we didn't have a Americans abroad for Dean sign. So we put that up immediately, and the thank you came from Spain. All this happened in a 10-minute part of time that was an amazing exchange between us and our supporters, and they saw the mistakes we made, and we plugged them. And that same thing would in any other presidential campaign I've been involved in would have probably taken 3 or 4 months. I mean, no one in Puerto Rico would even know that there were signs, and the people in California would have to try to figure out where the L.A. headquarters was and how they'd have to get in their car to go get them. And so in a lot of ways, the blogs made us a lot stronger, a lot smarter. And that was a small thing, but some of them were really huge events that ideas that really made the campaign take off.
Now, there are ways to subvert the internet. There are ways to use dirty tricks in email and on the internet. Did you feel that your blog or that your email campaigns were undermined at any point through dirty tricks?
Yeah, but I don't. You know, back in the old days when Thomas Jefferson was running for president, it was difficult to go negative on the guy. You know, how do you say too soft on crime or has no leadership to attack the guy who wrote the Declaration of Independence? It's kind of tough to do. So John Adams got a bunch of guys on horseback and they ran around the states saying that Jefferson was dead, which was kind of hard to disprove back then. You couldn't hold a newspaper up with the date on it, picture of Jefferson, and get that around. They just had to get guys on horseback on Jefferson's side running around screaming, "He's alive, he's alive," trying to disprove a negative, which is often tough to do. So we've had those kind of tactics since the very early days of the Republic. It's nothing new. On the net, it is out there. I mean, we had an email go out. Somebody sent an email out from Dean for America's, with an S, not Dean for America, but you had to look real close, signed it with my name and sent it out to hundreds of thousands of people with me saying that we needed volunteers, but please don't volunteer if you're gay, because in all of our states, the bunking quarters are close or something like that. And this thing really did take on a life of its own, and to the point where Iowa TV stations were running that I had sent this out. I literally had to go on the air in Iowa and, you know, and say I didn't send it out. Here's a guy who wrote this, a candidate who wrote the civil, you know, signed the civil unions bill for gay and lesbian couples, giving them the most basic rights and the only state to have done it at that point. And this email's floating around there. It was just totally fabricated and was the antithesis of what the campaign was about. So those kinds of things happened. But again, with the internet, you've got, and the media today, you can go right on, you know, right back out and say it's not true, at least in a way that you might have a chance of convincing people. I think the negativism that was there in the early days of the Republic was a lot tougher on horseback to fight.
I want to ask you about the so-called "I Have a Scream" speech, which Howard Dean gave after the Iowa caucuses. And, you know, he named in a loud voice in a crowded room the states that he hoped to win in. And this was played over and over and over again on the TV news and was used kind of as a symbol of Howard Dean uncorking, losing his cool. What does this tell us about his character? I looked for "I Have a Scream" in your index. You refer to this in your index as Iowa concession speech. what was that whole episode like for you? And actually, let me start with this. Since you've been talking so much about the importance of the internet, if you Google "I Have a Scream" and Howard Dean, what you come up with first is a lot of remixes. There were a lot of people who took the "I Have a Scream" speech and remixed it and put it on their website. Was that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, you live by the internet and you pay the price. We had a lot of Dean mixes of great speeches that happened early on. In fact, the DNC speech that just sort of launched his candidacy from, I think, March of 2003 was remixed over and over again and really spread all over the net and helped get us off the ground. So I think, you know, the remixes are kind of fun, and you know, I listened to both of them, and a lot of them were great. But I think what happened there is, I mean, that room was 3,000 people easy going out of their minds, you know, really screaming and hollering and applauding and cheering. And he was just trying to get hurt. I mean, he was trying to, if you look at the real tapes of the thing from behind in the crowd, not the ones you saw on television, it's just a guy rallying his troops and doing it loudly because he couldn't hear himself. I mean, you could mm-hmm. not hear yourself in that room. The most amazing thing to me, having been involved in Gary Hart's campaign in 1988, you know, there's something wrong going on here when a guy like Gary Hart, who understood terrorism, the threat of terrorism in 1988, was campaigning saying that we had to retool our military, had to make it leaner, more agile, that the Soviet Union was no longer the threat, that the threat was terrorist and unstable third world states. And we all got caught up in this personal life stuff, and there was a mistaken judgment there on his part. But we relegated him to the back benches because of a mistake he made in 1988. You know, you look at that and you look at 2003 and you look at post-September 11th, 2001, and you wonder who made the bigger mistake, Gary Hart or all the sort of gossipy press stuff that destroyed him. And now
the mistake you're referring to is his affair with Donna Rice.
Donna Rice. Yeah. But now we're getting to the point where, and this is where I'm not apologizing for Gary Hart. I'm just posing the question. But then you have to ask yourself, what have we come to when we now run a guy out of the race because he actually shows emotion? I mean, he actually, because he yells at his concession speech. That's why we roll him off the stage. And even in 1988, the press was more interested in tailing Gary Hart than tailing his stands on changing the military to prevent future terrorist attacks. This guy knew more in 1988 about terrorism than any other person, than most of the guys running today.
My guest is Joe Trippi. He managed Howard Dean's presidential primary campaign and has written a new book about using the internet in politics. Let's hear one of the I Have a Scream remixes from the internet. This one is mixed with the Outkast hit, Hey Ya. We'll start with the actual soundbite from Dean's Iowa concession speech.
We're going to California and Texas and New York, and we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan, and then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House. Yeah!
So what was your approach to doing damage control after the I Have a Scream thing?
Well, I mean, from my point of view, we were pretty terminal before that speech ever happened. I mean, that speech just meant that it was going to be very difficult to ever get back, although I had my doubts about that anyway. We had taken such a pounding in Iowa I think we make too much of that speech today. I don't think it was the last straw or anything. But in terms of damage control, I mean, we did everything we could do. But, I mean, we went on Letterman's show, made fun of ourselves on the top 10 list. We, did the Diane Sawyer interview on ABC with the governor and Judy Dean, his wife. I think they did great. And he did very well in a debate in that period too, where we were all trying to push back on this. But the problem was, is that we were shooting single bullets, you know, one at a time. We were shooting and rolling, and the entire national media was out there with Uzis, with that tape, I mean, of the speech in Iowa, just literally machine gunning us. And so, you know, shooting and rolling wasn't doing any good.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of the interview I recorded last week with Joe Trippi. He managed Howard Dean's presidential primary campaign and used the internet to mobilize voters, raise money, and transform Dean into a front runner. Trippi has written a new book about the internet and politics called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Trippi left Dean's campaign last January. Now, Howard Dean hired Roy Neal to run the campaign. After how long had you been managing it?
I think about 13 months. Mm-hmm.
Then you left the campaign. Now, Neal had worked with Al Gore. Gore had endorsed Dean in the primary. One school of thought says that this was all bad for Dean because it made him seem more establishment and less like the insurgent candidate. You're a partisan here, but would you agree with that?
No, I think Gore didn't hurt because it was an establishment endorsement. Gore hurt because the day he endorsed us, it meant all the other campaigns, all of them in unison, decided they had to destroy Howard Dean. And I think the National Press Corps didn't say destroy Howard Dean. They just said, oh, my gosh, this guy's going to be the nominee, and we have a responsibility to ask him the tough questions and test his mettle, which the press does have that responsibility. And I think those two forces, there was no conspiracy, but those two forces combined. And a third thing, I think, which needs to be said, we were many, many things. One of the things we were, essentially, was, you know, an amateur baseball team playing in the majors. And I don't mean that in any disrespect to anybody, but the governor had never run for office before, really. He'd become governor when the sitting governor, Snelling, passed away of a heart attack, so he didn't run for governor. The first time he ran for re-election, no one real ran against him. And then a testament to his governing, he really did get health care for those kids. He really did get prescription drug benefits for those seniors, lowered the income tax twice. No one real ever ran against him. He essentially ran against Bozo the Clown for president every year, for governor every year that he was re-elected. So you have both of those forces moving in on us, and Governor Dean, who is in the first real campaign of his life, and it's not for Congress, it's not for governor, it's for President of the United States. And he, me, and others in the campaign made some rookie mistakes there the last 3 or 4 weeks that were not anybody's fault. It's not his fault that he was such a good governor. He never had a tough race.
What's a mistake in retrospect you think you've made?
Oh, I made a bunch. I mean, the biggest one... It was, I was on a crossfire with Paul Begala and Tucker Carlson about 4 days before Iowa, and our momentum's slowing down. We cannot have a mistake right then. I hadn't made a mistake with the press up to that point, not a real bad one, luckily, because it's only luck that you can get through 13 months without blowing yourself up at least once, and I blew myself up and the campaign up a little bit. 4 days before Iowa, when Tucker Carlson, I think, turned to me and said, geez, you've got all these congressional endorsements. You got Gore. You got Tom Harkin. Who's next? Jimmy Carter? And I knew that we were meeting with Jimmy Carter in Plains, Georgia on Sunday. So I said, tune in Sunday and find out. Well, I also knew Carter wasn't going to endorse us. It was a jokey quip. The next thing that happened, CNN and the entire news media goes into Dean to be endorsed by Carter and on Sunday. Carter's going to great lengths to say, I didn't invite Dean down here and I'm not going to endorse him. So here we are, you know, 4 days before Iowa, and now I've launched a controversy about whether Carter's endorsing us, whether we're trying to pull a fast one, all for what was going to be an innocent stop to go to church with Jimmy Carter in Plains, Georgia, suddenly turned out to be, you know, a terrible hit for the campaign. I did that. You know, there were others. I'm not, you know, my point of view of this thing is that a presidential campaign is really tough. We had a lot of great people. Most of them came on their own, drove up from Utah or Alabama, kids who'd never worked on a campaign before, who were suddenly running huge chunks of the country because of their energy. We couldn't get the A-team of Democratic Party politics to come work for Howard Dean. They thought we were ridiculous. They thought he had no chance. They weren't going to waste their time or their careers on him. And so we had this great, amazing campaign of amateurs, essentially, who ran circles around the New York Yankees, the Los Angeles Dodgers, and the Red Sox for 13 months.
One last question. At the beginning of the interview, you said that you went to work for Howard Dean, even though you'd sworn off presidential politics, because you love him. You still love him. I mean, he replaced you with somebody else. He lost. Do you still love him?
I think Howard Dean showed more courage than just about any politician I can think of throughout that campaign. He was against that war when 80% of the American people were for it. This guy stuck his chin out and changed this party and helped change the country. I'm happy that he let me have any opportunity to be a part of it. I'm proud of what I did. I'm proud of continuing my fight. He had every right to make the changes in his campaign. It was his campaign.
One last question. What is the greatest way that you think the Dean campaign changed the Democratic Party?
I think the party didn't think it could beat Bush. It just did. It was so afraid of taking Bush on. They were so afraid of him. They were afraid of his favorability ratings. They were afraid of the war president, that many of them voted for the war out of fear, not out of conscience. I think many of them support. Yeah, 99 senators support the Patriot Act. Only one, Russ Feingold, had the bold guts to say, no, I'm not supporting this thing. It's taking America's citizens' rights away. You know, Dean was the first guy to come along and say, what the hell is going on here? What's gone on with the where did the principles of this party go? And he called the party out on it, and the grassroots said, yeah, finally someone's speaking the truth. And what happened was congressmen out there, other senators, most of the candidates, including John Kerry, started to move towards Dean's positions, at least in rhetoric, if they couldn't change their votes. But I think it really woke up the party and woke up an energy and activism in this country that's so sorely needed if we're really going to change the system.
Well, Joe Trippi, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Joe Trippi's new book is called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.